Law number 16, the law of the Big Mo. Momentum is a leader's best friend. If ever there was a person with talent and vision, it was Ed Catmull. In 1979, filmmaker George Lucas hired Catmull to run the computer graphics division of Lucasfilm Limited. Catmull tried to convince Lucas to let him try to make computer-generated feature films, but the technology was still in its early stages and too expensive. Instead, Lucas decided to sell the division. In 1986, Steve Jobs bought it by paying $5 million for it and putting an additional $5 million into the company. He named it Pixar. While it was struggling to become profitable, Pixar began making short films to demonstrate the power of its technology. The first was called Luxo Jr. It shows two animated desk lamps interacting as a parent and a child would. Luxo Jr. was so good that it was nominated for an Academy Award. But Catmull and his team were still a long way from achieving his dream of creating a full-length feature film. The company's greatest challenge at that time was merely surviving. Then in 1991, because of the credibility Pixar had earned, it got a significant break. The leaders thought the company was ready to take its next big step, creating a one-hour television special. John Lasseter, an animator who teamed up with Catmull, approached Disney, his former employer, to pitch the idea. The response amazed him. Disney offered a contract to create three full-length feature movies using computer animation. Disney would fund and distribute the projects. Pixar would create them and receive a percentage of the profits. Pixar finally had an opportunity to fulfill Catmull's vision, but the company was still far from realizing it. The company got to work on what would become Toy Story, but the team had trouble with the characters and the story. It would take Pixar 4 years to make the movie. Though the rest of the world wasn't seeing it yet, Pixar was starting to develop momentum. That became obvious to everyone when Toy Story opened in November 1995. When the contract with Disney was signed 4 years earlier, Pixar's CEO, Steven Jobs, estimated that if the first movie was a modest hit, say $75 million at the box office, we'll both break even. If it gets $100 million, we'll both make money. But if it's a real blockbuster and earns $200 million or so at the box office, we'll make good money and Disney will make a lot of money. Few people would have predicted that it would make $192 million domestically and $362 million worldwide. From that time, Pixar's momentum has been strong and, if anything, has continued to grow. The organization has won 17 Oscars and been awarded 42 patents. And since Toy Story came out, the company has produced hit after hit: A Bug's Life, Toy Story 2, Monsters, Inc., Finding Nemo, The Incredibles, and Cars. Worldwide, those movies have earned more than $3.67 billion. Ironically, while Pixar was gaining momentum, Disney, the company who helped it create its breakthrough, was losing momentum. Disney's animation division had fallen on hard times. Its last significant animated movie was Lilo and Stitch in 2002. And it had produced three highly expensive bombs: Atlantis, Treasure Planet, and Home on the Range. How could Disney possibly regain some momentum? Bob Iger, who became Disney's president and CEO in October 2005, knew how. He purchased Pixar. Now the people Disney once helped were helping Disney. Catmull became Disney's president of feature animation, and Lasseter was made chief creative officer. Disney has had two major heydays, says Catmull. We're going to make a third. And what about Pixar? It will continue to function as before under the care of Catmull and Lasseter. When you've got great momentum, you don't want to do anything to get in its way. After all, momentum is a leader's best friend. Many times, it's the only thing that makes the difference between losing and winning. When you have no momentum, even the simplest tasks seem impossible. Small problems look like insurmountable obstacles. Morale becomes low. The future appears dark. An organization with no momentum is like a train at a dead stop. It's hard to get going, and even small wooden blocks on the track can keep it from going anywhere. On the other hand, when you have momentum on your side, the future looks bright. Obstacles appear small, and troubles seem inconsequential. An organization with momentum is like a train that's moving 60 miles per hour. You could build a steel-reinforced concrete wall across the tracks, and the train would plow right through it. When leadership is strong and there is momentum in an organization, people are motivated and inspired to perform at higher levels. They become effective beyond their hopes and expectations. If you remember the 1980 U.S. Olympic hockey team, you know what I'm talking about. The team was good, but not good enough to win the gold medal. Yet that's what the Americans did. Why? Because leading up to the championship game, they won game after game against very tough teams. They gained so much momentum that they performed beyond everyone's expectations. And after they beat the Russians, nothing could stop them from coming home with the gold medal. The same kind of thing is true in business and volunteer organizations. When an organization has great momentum, all participants are more successful than they would be otherwise. I'll tell you how I know that that's true. If you see leaders, especially mid-level ones, who have had great success in an organization with momentum, leave that organization and suddenly their performance becomes merely average, you know the law of the Big Mo was at work. Even average people can perform far above average in an organization with great momentum. Momentum is easier to steer than to start. Have you ever been water skiing? If you have, you know that it's harder to get up on the water than it is to steer once you're up there. It takes a leader to create momentum. Followers can catch it. Good managers are able to use it to their advantage once it has begun. Everyone can enjoy the benefits it brings, but creating momentum requires someone who has a vision, can assemble a good team, and motivate others. If the leader is looking for someone to motivate him, then the organization is in trouble. If the leader is waiting for the organization to develop momentum on its own, then the organization is in trouble. It is the leader's responsibility to initiate momentum and keep it going. U.S. President Harry Truman once said, "If you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen." But for leaders, that statement should be changed to, "If you can't make some heat, get out of the kitchen." If you don't believe in the vision and enthusiastically pursue it, doing all that you can to bring it to fruition, then you won't start making the small gains required to get the ball rolling. However, if you model enthusiasm to your people day in and day out, you attract like-minded people to your team, department, or organization and motivate them to achieve. You will begin to see forward progress. Once you do, you will begin to generate momentum, and if you're wise, you'll value it for what it is, the leader's best friend. Once you have it, you can do almost anything. That's the power of the Big Mo. Several years ago, I saw a movie called Stand and Deliver that illustrates the hopelessness many people feel in an organization without momentum. Maybe you've seen it too. It's about a real-life teacher named Jamie Escalante, who worked at Garfield High School in East Los Angeles, California. Teaching, motivating, and leading were in Jamie Escalante's blood even from the time of his youth in native Bolivia. He quickly became known as his city's finest teacher. When he was in his 30s, Escalante and his family immigrated to the United States. He worked several years in a restaurant and then at Russell Electronics. Though he could have pursued a promising career at Russell, he went back to school and earned a second bachelor's degree so that he could teach in the United States. Escalante's burning desire was to make a difference in people's lives. At age 43, he was hired by Garfield High School to teach computer science. But when he arrived at Garfield on the first day of class, he found out that there was no funding for computers. And because his degree was in mathematics, he would be teaching basic math. Disappointed, he went in search of his first class, hoping that his dream of making a difference wasn't slipping through his fingers. The change from computers to math turned out to be the least of Escalante's problems. The school, which had been empty and quiet during his summertime interview, was now in chaos. Discipline was non-existent. Fights seemed to break out continually. Trash and graffiti were everywhere. Students and even outsiders from the neighborhood roamed all over the campus throughout the day. Gang activity was rampant. It was a teacher's worst nightmare. Almost daily he thought of quitting, but his passion for teaching and his dedication to improving the lives of his students wouldn't allow him to give up. Yet at the same time, Escalante was enough of a leader to know that the students were doomed if the school didn't change. They were all sliding backward fast, and they needed something to move them forward. When a new principal was brought in, things began to change for the better. But Escalante wanted to take it further. He believed that the way to improve the school was to challenge the school's best and brightest with a calculus class that would prepare them for an AP class, earning them college credit. In the fall of 1978, Escalante organized the first calculus class, rounding up every possible candidate who might be able to handle the course from Garfield's 3,500 student population. He was able to find only 14 students. In the first few classes, he laid out the work it would take for them to prepare for the AP calculus test at the end of the year. By the end of the second week of school, he had lost 7 students. Even the ones who stayed were not well prepared for calculus, and by late spring, he was down to only 5 students. All of them took the AP test in May, but only 2 passed. Escalante was disappointed, but he refused to give up, especially since he had made progress. He knew that if he could help his students experience a few wins, build their confidence, and give them hope, he could move them forward. He was determined to do whatever it took. To motivate them, he'd give them extra homework or challenge one of the school athletes to a handball match. Escalante never lost. If they needed encouragement, he'd take them out to McDonald's as a reward. If they got lazy, he'd inspire, amaze, amuse, and even intimidate them. And all along the way, he modeled hard work, dedication to excellence, and desire. The next fall, Escalante put together another calculus class, this time with 9 students. At the end of the year, 8 took the test and 6 passed. He was making progress. Word of his success spread. Students heard that Escalante's protégés were earning college credit, and in the fall of 1980, his calculus class numbered 15. When they all took the test at the end of the year, 14 students passed. The steps forward weren't huge, but Escalante could see that the program was building momentum. The next group of students, numbering 18, was the subject of the movie Stand and Deliver. Like their predecessors, they worked very hard to learn calculus, many coming to school at 7 a.m. every day, a full hour and a half before school started. And often they stayed until 5, 6, or 7 p.m. And though Educational Testing Service questioned the validity of the first test students took, they had to take it a second time. 100% of them passed. After that, the math program exploded. But the benefits of the law of the Big Mo were felt by all of the Garfield High School students. The school started offering classes to prepare students for other AP exams. In time, Garfield held regular AP classes in Spanish, calculus, history, European history, biology, physics, French, government, and computer science. In 1987, 9 years after Escalante spearheaded the program, Garfield students took more than 325 AP examinations. Most incredibly, Garfield had a waiting list of more than 400 students from areas outside its boundaries wanting to enroll. The school that was once the laughing stock of the district and that had almost lost its accreditation had become one of the top 3 inner city schools in the entire nation. That's the power of the law of the Big Mo.